Welcome everyone to this live session at Best Ideas 2022. It's a great pleasure to welcome to this session Ken Majmudar and Sam Namiri. Ken founded Ridgewood Investments in 2002 and serves as Chief Investment Officer, focusing on managing long-term value investing-based strategies. Prior to founding the firm, Ken worked for 7 years on Wall Street as an investment banker at Merrill Lynch and Lehman Brothers, where he has extensive working experience in IPOs, M&A transactions, and other corporate finance advisory work for Fortune 1000 companies. Ken graduated with honors from the Harvard Law School in 1994 after being an honors graduate of Columbia University in 91 with a bachelor's degree in computer science. He is a CFA charter holder. Sam Namiri is a portfolio manager and partner at Ridgewood Investments, where he concentrates on managing the Ridgewood Select Value Fund, which focuses on small and microcap companies. Prior to Ridgewood, Sam was an associate at Grand Slam Asset Management, a small cap hedge fund, and also the founder and president of Shop Network, a jewelry company, which he led in producing a reverse auction TV show selling jewelry that aired on DirecTV. Sam also started an overseas jewelry plant and developed a global supply chain. He has a BS in industrial engineering and operations research from UC Berkeley and an MBA from Columbia. So great to have you guys with us again this year. I really look forward to your presentation. So without further ado, I want to turn it to you guys. Please go ahead.
Thank you, John. Appreciate the kind introduction and the invitation to present again. So let me just introduce a little bit of our work at our fund and then go right into our idea this year. So Sam and I run several strategies in my case, but Sam and I together run the Ridgewood Select Value Fund, which is focused primarily on small and micro cap companies. That's where we got together and partnered. So we've been running this fund since April of 2018. And we just summarize here our approach, which is reflected in the idea that we're going to share today, which happens to be quite a micro cap idea that we really like. And similar to, I guess, sort of the Buffett School value investors, we generally take concentrated positions in the fund. We do a lot of fundamental research to understand the companies that we own. We tend to be quite long-term oriented. And for us, that means sort of we tend to take at least a 3+ year view on our holdings, often much longer. We try to find compounders. And part of our approach is really to approach, even though they're public companies, to look at them as if we were going to invest in or buy the entire company. So we very much like to think like an owner would if that owner owned the majority of the outstanding shares of a company. So almost like a quasi-private equity type of an approach to public company investing. And a lot of our differentiation is that we do extensive due diligence, and we do visit companies, we go to trade shows, and we really emphasize the quality of management and especially focus on their capital allocation abilities as evidenced by their past actions as well as their plans for the future. And that's one of the big areas of focus when we do meet with management. We try to ask them about capital allocation, how they think about it, and what frameworks they use to allocate capital well. And as it says here, if anybody wants to be on our mailing list, we just email Sam at Ridgewood Investments with an S.com, and we'd be happy to include you on our future updates and keep you informed on our fund and what we're thinking. So this is our fourth presentation of Best Ideas. So we thought it might be appropriate to give a little bit of a update on the three other ideas that we presented. So in sort of order, so we presented Farmer Brothers, which is a coffee roaster slash distributor in the United States. And that one is one of our misses so far, although we actually do think it still has, or from today's prices, which are down substantially from where we presented it, we think it's actually quite interesting. We do own a Farmer Brothers right now. It's a substantial position. And obviously what happened, one of the things that happened with Farmer Brothers is they're primarily, their business is to serve tens of thousands of retail endpoints who sell coffee as part of their, offering of food or beverage, and including sort of like cafeterias, but also retail locations, a lot of independent retail locations. And so the pandemic, it was really at least two factors. One is the prior management team, we think, made some wrong moves, but then the pandemic really shut down a lot of their end customers. Now they have a new management team that we've met who we really like, and they seem to be doing a lot of the things we wished the old management team would do. And then obviously the pandemic is still a factor, but much more of the customers have opened up. The management team has also made some moves on the efficiency front. So anybody that may have seen our old presentation or wants to go back and look at it, if it's accessible, or wants to reach out to us, we actually think Farmer Brothers, though we're not going to present that today, is very compelling at today's prices. And so that was one of them. That was the first idea that we presented. A second idea that we presented was Bank of Internet, BOFI, which renamed to Axos Bank. And this one actually pretty much close to achieved, became close to achieving what we thought. And we considered this sort of a compounder. So far it's generated almost basically a 50% return in 2.5 years. So pretty solid. And then our third idea that we presented, which has also done quite well, was presented about a year ago, and that's CRAI is the ticker. So this company is essentially a consultant. So they consult almost like, you could say, a variety of niche consulting, mostly to companies as their clients or to litigation consulting or things like that, niche consulting. And we presented this idea at a year ago, almost a year ago today, and it has done quite well, and we continue to see upside there. So that's a quick summary. So today we're going to present a fourth idea, and we're excited to do so, and it's a microcap company. So the idea that we'll be presenting today is one that we've owned for some time and we really like. It's probably below the radar screen for many people, because it's quite a small company. Currently, the market cap is only 115 million. It's traded in the US on the New York Stock Exchange, and the ticker is ACU. The price as of within the last day or two was just over $32 a share. And we project that the 2-year price target could be around in the 50s. And actually the stock has come off quite a bit. So it was trading in the 40s, not very long ago, just earlier in 2021. And so some of what makes the idea compelling to us to present is just that there's an attractive entry point right now. And we forecast a quite attractive total return for those with a 2 to 3 year horizon. So What Acme does is it's actually a manufacturer and a supplier of a lot of niche little areas. So cutting tools, first aid products, measuring and sharpening products, nets. So a lot of its principal products are first aid kits, scissors, shears, knives, rulers, pencil sharpeners, nets. And so it has a lot of little niche areas and pretty good brands in each of those areas. And so this is kind of, I think, one of the types of companies that we really like. It's sort of like nothing exciting. Sort of you could consider it to be boring, almost like things that, you know, people need. They're not too expensive for the most part. They tend to have consumables involved or things that wear out or run out. So you tend to come back and buy another pair of scissors or, you know, whatever. And so we really like that sort of, it's not generally recurring from the customer point of view in all cases, although some of their areas are, like, for example, if you have a first aid kit in a workplace setting, you need to replenish those supplies just from a health and safety point of view as an employer. But you know, there's some pricing power. There's brand involved. They've been very good, as we'll describe, with solid capital allocation. And they've also been good. You know, traditionally, you don't think of companies like this as sort of technology companies, and they're not, but at two different levels. One is that they do obviously use technology to get more efficient and to manage their business better and so forth. But even more directly, they are innovating all the time in sort of incremental ways to make their products a better value, more durable, you know, or creating little other additional niches off of the areas that they're already in. And so we think that the current entry point is actually quite attractive for those who are interested in a medium to, you know, 2 to 3 year horizon. The company is actually very, very old, and it was founded originally, probably a predecessor, in 1867. But the current CEO, whom we know well and we quite like, Walter Johnson, joined the board in 1995 and then took over as CEO. And he's done a number of things over time. He's created more of an innovation sort of type of culture, but he's also, you know, consolidated manufacturing, moved production to lower cost areas, in, you know, even China. And we think overall he's a very good capital allocator. So we like a lot of what he's done, and it's reflected in the company, which has sort of been a steady, solid performer. So this is not a company that will, you know, grow astronomically in any given year, but we do think it's a solid, kind of consistent performer. And by the way, for context, I'm sure many people in the MOI community, you know, sort of follow this. And I think I even heard it, John, on your podcast, that there's a, in terms of stock market performance, until actually relatively recently, there was a lot of concentration in large U.S. companies, and particularly tech companies. Obviously, some of that has course corrected a little bit recently. But even after that, when you compare some of those companies to a company like Acme, which is a small, slow and steady little niche manufacturer at a relatively very cheap multiple, but can still grow and, you know, innovate and do tuck-in acquisitions, we really like this sort of steady, boring, well-managed and relatively inexpensive type of company. And it's also quite small, so there's a lot of room to grow, especially with a good CEO like Walter at the helm of the company. So let me turn it over to Sam to talk about how they built the company organically and through acquisitions. And then Sam can walk us through the rest of the thesis on Acme.
Thank you, Ken. And thank you, John, as well, for inviting us again. So I just wanted to start off with, you know, with the chart down below. Ken mentioned how Walter took over in 95. Really, he just took over the business and, you know, spent the first 5 years or so really just like righting the ship, making sure everything was okay, consolidating plants, moving over to China, investing in R&D. And then starting in 2000, started with a few acquisitions. The 2002 acquisition, or not acquisition, but the titanium coating, that was a big turning point, and I think realization for the company that, you know, investing in R&D and innovation is quite important. And with a titanium coating, what that does is on scissors or other cutting devices, it helps it keep it sharper and last longer. And it also helps it be non-stick as well too. So again, a huge innovation in the scissors and cutting industry. And then starting in 2011, the company really started ramping up its acquisitions and predominantly tuck-in acquisitions. And really what they all have in common is that they all share the same or similar customer base, especially on the cutting side, that they all have a similar customer base, and then on the first aid side as well too. And so they've kind of, they have these two buckets where they can acquire companies and allocate capital to. And a thing to note is that the company generally like doesn't go out there and use investment banks to look to acquire companies. They don't like to participate in auctions. They want to be like the only buyer really that's out there even talking to these companies. And they have their own internal database of companies that they've talked to and built relationships over the years. And it's usually like an arm's length company that they're dealing with already. So for instance, with Spill Magic, you know, the company knew that its first aid customers already in the past would love this product. And so when they acquired Spill Magic, they were easily able to, you know, sell that to their current customer base and add a ton of value. And what Spill Magic
tell them what that does. Yeah.
Spill Magic is a powder that you pour on liquids, and it absorbs the liquid, so you can just sweep it up very easily. And so, and you know, in situations like in retail, or in a distribution facility, you know, you want to prevent injuries quickly, and you also want to be able to clean things up quickly. And so that's what Spill Magic can do. So yeah, that's on that slide. And then just to give some more background on the company, Acme has quite an international footprint. But what's also been interesting as well is over the last few years, it's started to move a lot of its production or its acquisitions back to the US. I wouldn't say back to the US, but with new acquisitions has started manufacturing more in the US. And another thing that's important to note as well. So they have offices in China. They don't own any manufacturing in China, but they have quality control, and a lot of their R&D and the R&D they've done and the technology that they own, they actually do that themselves, and they keep a tight hold on that so that that's not taken any other IP in China or overseas. And they've also, another thing that's really key here is that in the US they own a good amount of their properties, especially in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. The company has its largest distribution center and facility. That one they own, and they actually were able to refinance the properties in December and pulled out around $8 million in cash at a fixed interest rate of 3.8%. And so now that it creates even more dry powder for the company to make some acquisitions with and allocate that capital effectively. And then just, it's not on this chart, but the company a few years ago also started getting some supply out of India as well too. Even though they don't have any offices there, they wanted to have a backup against China, just in case there's some risk and getting supply over there from over there. Another thing about the company that we really like is that, you know, according to the last proxy, the CEO owns 16.9% of the company. And so this is very important to us generally when we look at most investments is, you know, making sure that the management team is well aligned with shareholders. And so, you know, as the company wins and does well and the share price goes up, he benefits as well too. So,
One thing I want to add on this is, like one category of companies that we just generally like, at Ridgewood and I've been investing in for years and look for is sort of this, the owner operator company. So where the stake is so significant, which is actually pretty unusual, especially in larger companies, both significant as a percentage of the company and also significant to the person, that they really think and act like owners more so than they think as agents. So we love to see this where the CEO owns like, you know, double digits of a company.
Yeah. So, this slide, I just wanted to kind of go a little bit more in depth in terms of the products that the company has and also, you know, where they get their growth from. Again, it's not amazing growth. A lot of investors, especially in the microcap space, will look at things and, you know, look for these companies that can do like a few hundred percent in growth in revenue a year. That's not what we really have here. We have this steady state business, you know, that has pricing power. So in an inflationary environment, the company has been able to increase prices and they have stuck. Especially in the first aid business, one thing that kind of goes unknown is that there's a really nice refill business that's a very nice annuity. And so, you know, things expire. That's what's great about this business is that if you're a distribution facility or your manufacturing plant, you know, you need to have some basic things and comply with OSHA. That's one thing. And then also a lot of the stuff in the first aid kits expire. And so what Acme does is they actually have an app and they remind you, hey, you know, like you need to refill these things because you're not compliant with your first aid kits in your facility. So they've created an app that allows you to do that. They're starting to use technology. And that's kind of created, you know, the CEO mentions all the time, a nice annuity business there. And so the key is to kind of get in and have them use your first aid kits. And once they're in the facility, you kind of have this customer for life. And the two main competitors that Acme sees, the big competitors are Honeywell and Cintas. And Acme, you know, is a lot less expensive than the other two and you know, kind of takes market share based off of price and then also speed and customer service as well too. The key is here that the company provides a very nice value to its customers. And then, you know, the company made two acquisitions in 2020. First Aid Central is one, and that is a first aid company out of Canada. And so that really gave access to Acme to get into that market. You have to be a certified company to be able to actually sell first aid kits there to the industrial space. And then, so that was nice because now you're able to, you know, cross sell additional products that Acme had that First Aid Central didn't have to its current customers and also expand to their customer, their big chain customer base that Acme has good connections to, and now is able to do that in Canada. The other one was Mednap, and Mednap is a supplier, if you can see at the bottom, of towelettes, like antiseptics, you know, eyelens, towelettes as well too. And so that's a company that actually has its own manufacturing plant in Florida that's certified. And I believe it's one of three companies that is actually able to sell this and it's manufactured in the US. And so, not only the easiest synergy here for Acme was that now it's able to supply its own first aid kits with these towelettes. So that's a nice synergy there, but then also, they're able to now go after bigger customers. And especially made in the USA, you know, requirements for government, and government like hospitals and such, even the Army, they're able to now you know, potentially win these contracts as well too. So that is we think those were both two good acquisitions, and we haven't seen much of the benefit from them yet. But we shall start seeing that, and that shall continue to compound over time as well too. And then the other business that Acme has is the cutting side of things. It's really nice that, you know, they're able to do the R&D, and what they do is they start off and they test it on higher end products. And then as they're able to scale up manufacturing there, they're able to use the proprietary technology and bring that down market to the cheaper products or the less expensive products that they have. So we mentioned earlier the titanium nitride coatings, which, you know, again, are nonstick and keep the blade sharper longer. And then if you can see on like the bottom left, that little hand thing that's there, that's a cutting tool that uses a ceramic blade. And so that's great for opening up boxes. It's sharp enough to like cut boxes, but it's not sharp enough to cut off your finger. So that's been a pretty popular product over the last few years. And it's that type of innovation that we like, and we think is emblematic of, you know, what Acme is able to provide. And because it has such scale compared to these other companies out there, that, you know, there's only a handful of companies that can be able to invest in R&D and actually get a good return on it, in this space. And the competitors here are, the main competitors are 3M and Fiskars. Again, two very large companies that do a lot of other things as well, not just cutting. And so, again, Acme, because this is their niche, they're able to, you know, really focus on this and provide great service to their customers. I want to go over some things that just generally, you know, show that how Acme has grown over time and, you know, continues to perform well. And so, you know, if you look at the sales number, you know, sales have gone up, you know, I think over the last 11 years, like consistently, and we're, you know, on pace to do the same again this year. If you look at EBITDA again, you know, it's gone up consistently. There was a few year period in 2016 through 18 where it was flat. Most of this was, they were figuring out, you know, historically, you know, about 10 years ago, the company had, most of their sales were through big box chains, particularly Staples and Office Depot. And so, you know, as those big box chains, you know, shrunk, Acme was figuring out how to sell online. And so those 3 years, they spent and invested a good amount of money in figuring out online sales and online distribution. And, you know, they finally figured it out in 2019 and 2020.
And if you could go back to the sales slide just for 1 second, I just want to make one comment, which is, you look at their products and they have these two big areas that Sam already went over, the cutting side and the first aid side. And then within each one, there's all these other little niche products. And so one thing that we kind of like is the diversity of revenue streams. When you actually get granular to like a product level, like obviously some products are bigger than others, but you have products that are maybe just a few million dollars, and you have other products that are probably in the high single digits, low double digits of that one product. But when you aggregate it all together and you look at like 2020 with 164 million of sales, that's really made up of so many individual products, each one with its own room for innovation and, you know, kind of new little offerings and tuck-ins and things like that. And so the revenue is extremely diversified. So we really like that characteristic of it, and largely has a sort of either recurring or sort of a intermittently wearing out type of nature to it. And so some of this growth comes from a little bit of like innovation, a little bit of organic pricing, a little bit of tuck-in acquisitions. And we really like this sort of steady, slow but steady upward trajectory of sales, and obviously carries through to EBITDA and net income, as Sam is about to go on to.
And we should have probably had a slide on this, but the company owns and has a lot of brands as well too that it sells through. So the scissors, you know, the scissors, the main scissors brand is Westcott. You know, they have a different brand for knives. On the first aid side as well too, they have a few different brands, but especially on the cutting side, they have, you know, four or five brands that are very popular, and each have their own niche, whether it's in hunting, or for the home, like school supplies and such. So, that also diversifies a lot of things out. So I just wanted to follow up on EBITDA, the net income line also, has in general increased over time. And, again, like the 2017, 2018 time period was the transition more to figuring out online sales. And so that was kind of the hiccup there. And obviously in 2020, everyone had to figure out how to sell online. So, they were well prepared for that. And, I just want to kind of say the other thing is, the CEO is always thoughtful about earnings per share. As a owner himself in the business, this is a very important line for him, to make sure that, as on the share count stays relatively flat. And then also, he always mentions in every single investor conference and presentation he makes is that, the shareholders are his partners. And so, we see a naturally, an increase in earnings per share, over the last decade. And we expect that to kind of continue as well too. And lastly, the dividend, this company gives dividends, and has increased that over time. Typically at the beginning of the year, it increases its dividend. It didn't do so in 2020, obviously because of the pandemic. But we expect 2022 and beyond to see, increasing dividends as well. If history sticks, which we think it should. And it's well covered by the earnings of the company. So we don't see any risk to the dividend as well. So why does this opportunity exist with Acme? I think, obviously it's a very small company, in terms of market cap, and also the volume of the stock, it doesn't trade too much as well too. So I think that takes out a lot of, investors or funds who could potentially invest here. And I think also, reallocation of capital is something that, it's kind of hard to gauge and put a value to as well. And we think that just doesn't happen, or it's not as obvious here, in Acme, to see the compounding effects of that. And so, obviously we mentioned before that the company has a history of opportunistic acquisitions, and, you can go through how each one was discovered by the company, how the deal was made, how they structured it. But typically, the CEO really comes down to figuring out how do we grow earnings per share, on each acquisition. And so he wants to pay a fair price because he wants the seller to, be happy with the sale that they got. But he also wants to make sure that there's a lot of synergies. So again, they all sell into the same customer base, providing Acme with an increased wallet share, of that customer. And Spill Magic was that example, right? That can be sold to now all of its first aid customers as well. And also it's cutting customers that have retail locations. And then they also, historically, the CEO has used like low cost debt for acquisitions, and is pretty conscious of not over levering. So after he makes an acquisition, he typically waits for the debt level to come down again, and then to a range where he feels is comfortable to then do another acquisition. And that's why typically he's done, an acquisition every year to year and a half or so since 2011. We also think that, it's an attractive entry point here because obviously the stock's come down, from the mid 40s, but also the company announced a share buyback, on November 12th when the stock was around 36. So today when the stock's at around 32, it was announced via a 10b5-1 plan. So the, typical periods where a company cannot buy its own stock, during its dark periods, the company can do this now. So it had preset prices and such. And so we think that limits our downside, and it's a good time to buy back, which I'll go over a little bit more in detail. And so, I talked earlier about the growing dividends, but also if you look at the shares outstanding over the last, since Walter took over as CEO, in 95, it's pretty much been the same price, the same number of shares, sorry. And that's quite rare for microcap companies, as a lot of times the executives, you know, raise a lot of capital or give a lot of shares as compensation, and dilute the owners of the company, the current shareholders. So that hasn't really happened here. So that's something that we are quite happy with. So you know, talking about the share buyback, and doesn't make sense for the company to do that today. You know, we believe that the company's on pace to do around $195 million in revenues over the next 2 years, quite conservatively, and also, you know, get earnings on that revenue, again, pretty conservatively, of $11.5 million each year. And so with the market cap at $115 million, you know, we think that's a nice earnings yield right now of 10%. So we think that's a pretty good return on capital, especially, you know, on the $8 million they're able to cash out and refinance at a 3.5 or like in a 3% range of interest. So we think that's a nice yield. And then also, obviously, this doesn't include any benefits of an acquisition the company can make. They're sitting on approximately $12 million in cash right now, and the company, you know, because they deal with China with most of their supply, the company, prior to March of 2020, in that quarter, you know, increased their inventory levels because they weren't sure if what was going to come out of China at that time. So they wanted to make sure that they had enough supply on hand. And so they've kind of kept that going throughout, until now, even they still have more inventory on hand, and because of the supply chain issues, and they're actually ordering now for stuff that they're hoping to get this summer. So, you know, it's been very, they did a good job of keeping inventory on hand and making sure they've had enough over this time period, which I think has allowed them to get market share, you know, since COVID began as well too. So just want to talk a little bit about valuation and how we get to our price target. So we think that earnings can grow to, you know, organically, earnings can grow to $11.5 million, by the end of 2023. And, you know, the company on the last call mentioned that they're able to take price increases. You know, their cost has gone up, the cost of freight, the cost of manufacturing, the cost of steel that they use in, you know, as a primary base in a lot of their cutting products has gone up. And so they have pricing power, and they know they'll take pricing power, and they make sure that they keep their margin as well too during those times. And again, if you look back over the last 5 years, they've been able to do that as well on their products. So nothing new here. It's a low priced product. So, you know, a few pennies in a, you know, some pennies are like less than a dollar in price increases on an average product, you know, doesn't really change any buying decisions. So yeah, we expect earnings to be able to grow, and on revenues, again, not shooting for the sky. You know, typically it's, you know, high single to low double digit revenue increases that the company has had over time. And then, you know, we take out from that $11.5 million around $2 million, you know, in cash spent on dividends annually over the next 2 years. And we also assume no share buybacks in the way we, in our evaluation. And so even though they probably will buy back some shares is what we're expecting. So we equate that to around $16 million of free cash generated on the company over the next 2 years. It could even be more if the supply chain eases up, because they've had to put some working capital in to increase their inventory levels. But just on a conservative basis, we feel like $16 million is a good number. And then so just to keep going on that is the balance sheet currently has $13.3 million in cash and $51.2 million of debt. You won't see that on the last Q because they did refinance their properties and do a cash out. So that's what these are, the updated numbers, which is a net debt of $37.9 million. If you, you know, take the cash that we expect to be generated over the next 2 years, that should reduce the net debt to $22 million, assuming they don't they don't spend anywhere else. But here's where it gets interesting is that, you know, the 13 million that they currently have cash on hand and the investment of that into acquisitions, you know, that's really where the power comes in here of compounding. So we think that, you know, conservatively on acquisitions, the company should produce around 15% on that cash that they'll allocate on an annual basis. And so, you know, adding that should add another $4.5 million in earnings on the $30 million on the $30 million of total cash that they've generated over the 2 years. So with 11.5 million of earnings power of 2023 earnings, and then you add another $4.5 million on the deployed capital that they have on acquisitions, we expect the earnings to be $16 million at the end of 2023. And so if you take the company's average multiple over the last 5 years of 13 times earnings, this is the average next 12 forward multiple, and then the $16 million of earnings, this gets us a market cap of $208 million. And with 4 million shares fully diluted, gets a price of $52 a share. And so during that time, we expect dividends of at least $1.12. And that gives a total shareholder value of $53.12 a share. If you own the stock today over that time period. So, which comes out to a 64% return from the current share price of $32 and change. So obviously with any investment, there are risks. And so one of the things that we see as a potential risk is, you know, for a company of this size of 115 million market cap, the executive compensation is higher than others that we've seen. And so here is a chart of what they've, you know, of the last 2020 and 2019's exec comp. And so, you know, the top three executive compensation totaled, you know, over $3.5 million in 2020. And, you know, on net income of $11.5 million, that's approximately 32% of the net income gets paid out in exec comp. However, to an acquirer, you know, this could be, you know, a way this would be more valuable to an acquirer because they'd likely be able to remove the executives, you know, and make the actual assets in the business of Acme even more valuable. And then also, I don't know if I have this chart here. If you go back to the chart of the shares outstanding, total shares outstanding, they recently issued a lot of shares and options, diluting shareholders. So we hope this is a one-time thing, and we don't see it again. But that's a risk that, you know, with almost every public company, especially in the market cap space, that a company can do a raise or issue a lot of employee stock options or shares. Other risks.
You know, I wanted to say on that point that we know the management well, and this is relatively recent, and it seems actually honestly a little bit out of character. And we've asked them about it, and they kind of indicated like, hey, you know, it's a retention thing or whatever. So, you know, we don't love it. It's not like completely crazy, but it's from our point of view, given the size of the company, it's a little aggressive. So it's not something we love. We do like the management. They've done a great job, and you know, they deserve to be paid. We just probably said this seemed a little aggressive to us, even though we do like the management team and they've done a great job over time. This was just one relatively recent kind of thing that we were slightly like, you know, wondering where this came from, sort of a little bit. So we wanted to just flag it for people.
Yeah. And then obviously another risk is that, you know, demand for their products can drop, in particular cutting and sharpening, which is not as recurring. It's not as like annual recurring as a lot of the first aid and medical products that Acme sells and has to refill and re-up for their customers. And then also our model assumes the company can get, you know, again, not crazy growth, but, you know, a reasonable growth in line with what it's historically done and maintain margins so that the price increases that they've recently taken hold. And then also another risk is, you know, if they deploy excess capital poorly, such as a poor acquisition. However, you know, again, if the history of the acquisitions have been quite positive, and you know, they pay a fair price, a reasonable price for things, and everything is based off of, you know, cash flow and the assets they're acquiring and such. So, and also they haven't made any huge acquisitions that are extremely transformative for the company, at least not in the last decade. They've all been tuck-in acquisitions. So that also, you know, de-risks this risk, this potential risk as well. So that's our presentation on Acme. Hope you enjoyed it, and you know, see why we find this as an attractive investment and an attractive point to get in as a shareholder of the company.
Great. Thank you so much, Ken and Sam. Just a reminder to everyone listening, if you do have a question, click the Q&A icon in Zoom and you can write it in. Take a question from the queue. It seems earnings growth was fairly modest for many years, but went up significantly since the start of COVID. Do you know why earnings went up so much in the last 2 years, and what reasons are there to expect the new level of earnings to be sustainable?
Yeah, so the reason it's gone up is, you know, during COVID, you know, a lot of companies, right, were scrambling and figuring out, you know, how, what's going to happen to our revenues. You know, again, they sell a lot of supplies that go into schools and students. And so, you know, when schools are out of session, schools are closed, you know, this company was quite worried at the time. So what do you do when that happens is you cut the fat. And so this company was able to lean up, you know, consolidate, you know, figure out exactly, you know, where they needed people, where they didn't need people. And so that was, that's really predominantly where a large amount came from. And then also the company was able to, like, you know, it actually coincided around the time where they actually figured out how to do online sales as well. Like that year prior, they had figured it out, and it didn't really show in the numbers because they had invested in a new system, like a distribution system as well. And they expanded their distribution facility as well too. So you don't see that in earnings as much until a lot of those costs went away.
But if you go back to the net income slide or the EBITDA slide, I think you, even though there's a little bit of lumpiness, and you described what happened between 16 and 20, which was related to this transition from selling through retailers to other distribution channels. And so that was where you see that. If you actually, I would say, to answer that question, the underlying sort of implication that, hey, it's only been recently that earnings have grown is not really, if you actually go back further, here's a company that, you know, went from 5 million to now, you know, we're thinking 20 million soonish. So that's 4x growth in EBITDA. And similarly on net income, if you go to the net income slide, you know, it went from 2.8 million to, you know, what will be over 10 million. So this isn't if you go back to what we think is the right horizon of a longer term, you know, 5 to 10 year horizon, actually this is a company that grows its earnings, nothing like, you know, heroic in any 1 year, but if you're an owner over time, it does, you know, over time, we would think that earnings through good capital allocation, tuck-in acquisition, all these factors that Sam described, actually it's a nice steady, you know, over longer periods of time, I think we'll see earnings growth continue through all these different little levers that they have. So I don't think it's the case that it's literally a pandemic thing. It's only because we had this blip that they kind of had to kind of figure out how to deal with. But that's more of an unusual situation. Whereas if you look back over time, the same policies and this same management has generated earnings growth for quite a long time. And the stock has also done steadily well over a long period of time. Used to be like a low single digit value that the stock had. And now it's, you know, 30 something after trading off, you know,
yeah,
30% recently.
And then also just on the EBITDA number, this includes money. They received around $3 million from PPP. However, the net income doesn't include that number. They back that this is backed out in this chart. And so, yes, like on the surface, it may seem okay. Well, they got some PPP money. That's why this net income number went up, but that doesn't include that in that. So I just want to be clear. And then also, I think the other question was about private labeling. Is that right, John?
Yeah, exactly. And okay.
So actually a lot like Amazon, for instance, they do Amazon. They have an Amazon Basics, you know, scissor line and different type of scissors. I think they do some private labeling actually for some of their customers. However, I think other companies already do that. And so typically when you go to a big box or, online, you know, there are two or three different brands. There's usually like, either Fiskars or Westcott will be there. And then there'll be like another cheaper brand as well too. And so usually a store doesn't carry both Fiskars and Westcott. It's one or the other. And again, another reason why, you know, the sales have gone up is that the company has displaced Fiskars in some locations in 2020 as well. And so that's helped. And they've also, again, come out with more products, especially in the craft space. And that has helped as well too. The company, you know, again, replaced its other competitors in terms of crafts. So, I think private label potentially is a risk, but again, when you look at the products and you see, okay, well now I have a non-stick coating on this cutting product, or, they're coming out with something that's like a fulcrum that tightens the scissors. So you can pretty much control how tight the scissors are when you cut. And then also they have another, like a titanium carbide blade that keeps the blade very sharp. That's more for their knives. And again, they'll eventually potentially add that on to their scissors as well. So it's really that technology and that IP that can stop private labeling. And that's why they're able to charge a premium for their products versus like the basic scissors out there or other cutting products.
Yeah, and there's no major customer concentration, right?
So their two biggest customers, they have two customers over 10%, and those are Walmart and Amazon. And so really that's where most, most cutting supplies and, first aid kits get sold through those two channels, I'd say probably in the world. So those are their biggest customers. But again, it's quite distributed around the country and the world as well. So,
yeah. And I mean, obviously the point on those is that for the most part, those are channels to get to their true end customers. So really it's not, Amazon's not the customer. I mean, even though like, for example, I think Amazon is a customer of their, the box opening thing where it's been great, that it's reduced like injuries of their employees because now they have the ceramic blade. And so that's actually been very beneficial. But for the most part, when Amazon, Walmart are customer, that's representing, I mean, I would think thousands or, hundreds of thousands of actual end customers that are simply buying through Amazon or Walmart.
Okay, terrific. Well, I think we'll leave it there. Ken and Sam, thank you so much for joining us again this year and presenting this investment thesis to the MOI Global community.
Thank you. Thanks for everyone.
Thanks for having us. Yep. Thank you.
Thanks everyone for listening. Goodbye for now.